I'm Jennifer Gonzalez from the Cult of Pedagogy podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And get ready, because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Instant Relevance Podcast. The Instant Relevance Podcast is an educational podcast featuring the latest news and resources to make learning relevant for all students. Follow us on Twitter at InstantRel.
So we're back here at the Blended and Personalized Learning Conference here in Providence, Rhode Island with Mr. Sean Rubin, the Chief Education Officer of the Highlander Institute. Before I throw it back over to you and ask the first question, I see Sean all over the place. It seems like I bump into him everywhere. I think the most random place I bumped into Sean was a chess match that I was coaching at community prep school, and parents are coming in, picking up their kids for the other team. Sean steps in, picks up his son, just ends up that his son was playing chess against my team. Most random place to bump into someone, but
yes.
It was funny. Sean is all over the place. He has released a book called Pathways to Personalization. I know you've been all over the country, all over the state. Let me ask you this first. What's exciting you in education right now?
Oh, wow. I think the excitement level is always high with regard to me in education. I am one of the pieces I think is most wonderful about the role that Highlander Institute gets to play in the state is that we get to be involved in a lot of different classrooms, be involved in a lot of different school, district level, building level discussions. And it just seems like, you know, when we started this work in 2012, the quality, the depth, the focus of the conversation just continues to get to be more and more around how are we increasing the personalized practices and ways in which we're building student voice and agency and in classrooms. And so, you know, it's hard not to get excited about very specific examples where teachers are actually making breakthroughs in that. It's hard not to get excited about some of the ways in which systems are figuring these pieces out, because this is super complex stuff, and it's stuff that I think when we first got into it, we thought was going to be transformed relatively quickly and that we were going to see impact relatively quickly. And so I think one of the probably the most exciting thing for me right now is that it seems like more and more people are realizing that this is going to require a longer arc of change, are settling into that, are starting to think about this from a lens of continuous improvement and how do we actually make what we're doing better by knowing what our intention is when we start and creating opportunities to kind of check in and share the information as we go. I think there's a lot to be excited about, both here in Rhode Island, but also nationally around the ways the conversation is shifting.
I really like how you pointed out the fact that you began this with energy and passion and motivation and a desire for change, and you didn't see it right away. And in a lot of schools, when we bring in a tool or an idea or a curriculum or something new, and we're excited for change, we don't see it right away, we throw it away, we pick something new. But instead, you reflected on that and said, listen, this is still of value to us. It requires a larger arc of change. It requires more thoughtful leadership. It requires more duration to leadership. And that's a really interesting perspective to have taken, because in the idea of getting down deep to kids and modeling what personalized learning is about, we don't want our kids to learn everything right now and then look around like what's left to learn. So you have that model too. So how have you seen that bigger picture? I'm a district leader now as well. How do you see the picture of the Highlander Institute and the work you're doing personalizing learning for schools, like treating them as your individual students?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the challenges that, you know, in some ways we actually even created in a lot of ways is that in the very early days when we didn't have a lot of real examples or exemplars of this work, we kind of, deified the teachers that were actually doing the work in a way that really brought a lot of attention to them, gave them a lot of cachet within their local schools and districts. But what we didn't spend any time or energy doing was thinking about the how are we actually documenting it? How are we actually using that documentation to build scaffolds for the next teachers? Instead, we kind of said, well, we brought everyone to see these teachers, we highlighted these teachers, and then we kind of like almost victim blamed the other teachers by saying, why aren't you doing these things that your colleagues are doing? And I think that, you know, just like you wouldn't do that to a student in a classroom if they weren't understanding a particular piece of content or they didn't see any relevance in that particular content, we shouldn't be doing that to teachers. There are great teachers that are at a range of different types of modalities, even ones that are incredible sages on the stage that that do incredible work and get good outcomes for kids. And to just think that by taking that teacher who knows their practice is amazing and bringing them into a classroom that's doing things in a blended or personalized way, that all of a sudden they're going to now both flip the switch in terms of their intentionality to change and then be able to just by seeing that be able to change or understand how to break down what the change would require. I think that was something that was a huge aha moment for us. And so that's really where the book was a huge step back for us, an opportunity for us to really interrogate the work that we'd done, to kind of look more closely at some of the ways that we had actually led people astray in some of these ways by promoting people in ways without actually thinking about the process. And so now we have this process. We have our Pathways to Personalization framework where we really are, you know, kind of expanding who gets to decide what matters. We're really thinking more intentionally up front about what is the current experience that students are going through and what are the assets of that experience versus where are the gaps and barriers in that current experience. And then starting the redesign process from that point with more voices at the table. I think that was the other challenge that we were dealing with, is that oftentimes we would be brought into a school or district by like a point person. And a point person might be a chief academic officer, or might be a building principal, or it might even be a teacher that came to the conference and just said like, hey, come into my classroom. But what happened was that we were working in isolation of the system, because that point person would assign us and say, okay, this is your cohort of teachers you're gonna work with, and then I'm gonna go back to my office and take care of the 75 other fires that I have to deal with. They weren't involved in that change process themselves, and they weren't actually thinking about beyond those teachers and themselves, who else needed to be in the conversation. How are we bringing students into the change design process? How are we bringing families into it? How are we bringing the community into it? So I think that in that process alone, we have kind of found a bone structure, if you will, for us to be able to return to, for us to be able to kind of like, it's built on a lot of assumptions now that we're going to use the next 3 years as an organization to test out. And right now we're really just looking for partners who really understand that this is at least a 3-year arc of change. We need all these voices at the table to start, and we're going to kind of work together to actually go through this road together.
I really like what you said in your keynote. You used the analogy of throwing spaghetti on the wall.
Yeah.
And exactly what you just said now, there's a certain modality of teacher that works for.
Mm-hmm.
Like it might work for me because I'm a little bit more of a cowboy in the classroom.
Yep.
Throwing that spaghetti on the wall, seeing what sticks, willing to try a lot of things. But that doesn't reach everybody. There's a lot of teachers out there that are way more careful, way more thought out than I ever am. I'm more of a seat of the pants type of person. But you're right, you know, this longer arc of change, we're gonna, you know, you hopefully be able to bring more teachers into the process, because I think that, you know, when it's presented as, oh, how about you just try this? How about you just try that? You know, you lose a lot of people in that process. You lose a lot of those veteran educators that have been doing this for a while and have been told that a million times by, you know, a million different things coming through. So ultimately what it comes down to is the students, though, right? And one thing that we talk a lot about on this podcast is how students have changed. You know, I've only been in the profession for 10 years, and in 10 years, students have changed immensely. And one thing that you brought up in your keynote again is, you know, what does an educated student look like in 2019? So that's actually my question to you. What does an educated student look like in 2019?
That's a great question. To be honest with you, like, it's not really the question for me. Like in our framework, in our model, we really deeply believe that that's got to be determined at the local level. There are so many different types of communities that these students are both living within but also potentially, you know, have aspiration to move to or to be a part of. You know, it's got to be a conversation where business and industry are involved. It's got to be a conversation where parents and families are involved. Higher ed has to be involved in that conversation. So I think that one of the challenges that we face, even in this work, is when we are attempting to be overly general in terms of answering that particular question, saying things like, you know, we need innovation, or we need digital, or we need, you know, any kind of like word that you try and grab onto at 30,000 feet to answer that particular question, I think is actually both distracting and potentially damaging. I think that really what needs to happen is that we need to be doing more student shadows in classrooms. We need to be doing more profiles of a graduate. We need to be doing more really deeply thinking about the range of competencies. There was a really transformative opportunity that I had to listen to a gentleman named, I think his name is Michael Bettersworth. But basically what his process was it brought a ton of industry professionals together in Texas. And he had them basically list out all of the competencies that they needed in their workforce. And then he actually made a database of those competencies in a way that he was able to see where there was overlap, which ones kind of bubbled up in higher demand. And then when students were actually kind of determining which pathways they wanted to go to, or which higher ed opportunities they wanted to go to, when they down selected from what the job was, he already had all those competencies kind of there, and then was able to build actual personalized coursework for those students that was targeted specifically at the skills that industry had kind of already pointed to. And so I think that's the kind of like really deep local questioning and redesign that needs to be happening. And then from there, then you can start to think about, okay, so then what does that look like at ninth grade? What does that look like at sixth grade? What does that look like at third grade? And how are we as a school or district going to actually, you know, move and shift our classrooms and our professional learning and our teachers toward that longer vision? My other big piece is that I really, really believe that, you know, it's silly how fast everything is changing. I mean, even what you guys are doing right here, setting up a podcast booth, live streaming on Twitter, all of these pieces are going to seem like antiquated and old school in like 2 years, right? And you're going to be able to like be doing this like on a scooter, wandering around the place. And so even to like to say or claim that how do we, at any point in time, how do we get it so that students can do this, you're already too late. And so I think that what we really need to be able to do is just become better at research and development, so that as new things come in, we're able to kind of bring them in quicker, we're able to test them and pilot them faster, we're able to extract the strategies that actually work based off of the outcomes that we care about, and then we have like really granular strategies and resources that we can get to more people quicker in that way if we get better at our research and development phase of this effort.
I totally agree that these things change so quickly that why are we still focusing on how to fit these changing pieces into a static world? And I think the question of what does an educated student looks like puts an end point or a finish line on education.
Exactly.
Well, they've been educated now, so because of that, they have this skill set or these things that would lead them towards this career.
Exactly.
So the personalization and the personalized learning viewpoint comes from what's an educatable student look like?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is somebody who is constantly able to continue to educate themselves and continue to learn? The lifelong learner phrase has been out there forever, yeah. But I want to be teachable later because I want to just be open to someone else's perspective and someone else's learning. And if those strategies are something that we extract as well from the process,
yep.
That what is it that's working that helps kids learn how to learn and helps kids create a desire and a motivation to continue to learn?
Yeah.
How do we make sure that those are pervading all of the content areas we have so that whenever an opportunity comes up for them later in something that might be outside of a content area that they feel strong in, they feel the desire to learn and get better at it? And
100%.
So, I'm excited about the book.
Thank you.
Because I feel like it speaks to a lot of that idea that pathways to personalized learning, and really turns into an opportunity to view myself as a learner who's making my own choices and directing my own way.
No, definitely.
And so I think our listeners want to make sure that they have an opportunity to connect with you. So how can they find you? How is the best way to get in touch with you? What's the best way to find you out there?
So probably on Twitter is the easiest. It's at Sean C. Rubin. Or at Highlander Inst, INST. But you know, to be honest, like if you just come, like look up the Highlander Institute, and you'll find us. You know, we're more than happy to connect. The book is available on Amazon, Pathways to Personalization, but you can also go to pathwaystopersonalization.com, which is a site where we're not only, you know, everything we do at the Highlander Institute is open source, and we try and get everything out there as far and as wide as we can. And so we're actually in a process right now of, for folks who are actually reading the book and digesting the book and getting into the book, both collecting resources, posting our own resources, and kind of aligning them based off of the structure and the scope and sequence of the framework. So it's probably a pretty powerful resource to kind of both come to and then return to over time, because it's going to build up as we go with this book.
And that's why I've really liked, you know, a lot of the resources that you guys, and I've gotten through some of the fellowship that I had with you guys, I keep coming back to, because it really does put a lot of structure around the work that we're doing, and it's been great being a part of the Highlander family over the last couple of years. I'm not originally from Rhode Island, so yeah. I want to thank you guys for bringing me in and educating me. I've changed my practice since moving to Rhode Island, so I want to thank you, first of all, for taking the time today. I know you're a busy guy, but also thank you for all the work you do. It's
and
great.
I want to turn it right back, because I think I also really deeply appreciate what you're doing also, Ray, here in Rhode Island, and what you guys are doing collectively as well, because I think that it takes connection points like you, who are constantly on Twitter, rejuvenating our ed chat in the state, like just really starting to bring together the blended learning network that you've put together. Like, that's the piece that actually is the scaling mechanism to be able to get this into more schools and more places. I mean, so many students that are still in classrooms where change is not even a conversation. And so I think that what you guys are doing in terms of disseminating and moving this stuff around the state and the country is really powerful. So keep it up, because
it gives
people a place where they feel like they can return to and have that opportunity to really feel connected. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for giving us your time today.
Awesome. All right.
Food wasn't the main reason I was in South Dakota. So.
No, well, you know, not that it's bad.
No,
but there's a lot more inspired cuisine in other places. You know,
we'll go with that. Yeah,
that's very political. I like that. Yeah,
we're all set. Steak.
Yeah, we're all set.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, welcome back to another short episode of the Instant Relevance Podcast. Now we are live again at the Highlander Institute with Jonathan Santos Silva, who was just one of the keynotes in this the main session here as well, and is also a Bridge Fellow for TNTP, the New Teacher Project. So welcome. Thank you for joining us for this time. We'd love to learn a little bit more about you. And in doing so, I'd love for you to share with us our main question here at the Instant Relevance Podcast, which is, what is it that is exciting you about teaching? What is it that's igniting your energy for education right now?
Sure, man. I think, you know, folks talk about equity a lot, and so that gets me going. I get excited about the idea of making sure that school is serving all kids. But what is especially or like uniquely motivating me and firing me up is this idea that when we talk about equity, you know, we're usually talking about students of color, but we forget to talk about indigenous youth. We're not talking about Native American students. We're certainly not thinking about kids who have grown up on reservations. And because of my experience as a teacher, teaching on Pine Ridge in South Dakota, that's something that's really near and dear to me and close to home. These are kids who are as talented, as incredible, have as many inspiring dreams as kids anywhere else. But for whatever reason, you know, our first Americans are often the last ones that we're thinking about in terms of, you know, serving them better, improving school and changing outcomes. So that's where my mind's at.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they hear equity, they assume one thing. You know, they assume inner city. They assume, you know, black and brown kids. And, you know, I've been in a lot of different schools. And I've been, I taught in Chicago. I teach now in Rhode Island in a more suburban district. There are equity issues everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And even equity issues that a lot of us don't know about, because, I mean, we're secluded in our own bubbles and don't understand. And one thing I want to ask you, because I listened to your keynote, you did a great job.
Thank you.
It was entitled, Why Personalized Learning? But the thing that you said that really hit home is schools are designed to sort kids. And you use the, I think a lot of us know the history of the Native American schooling system and, you know, even that is an example. Yeah. And we ask ourselves, even to relate that to today, like, how are we socializing, you know, how are we socializing students of color? How are we socializing, you know, students with trauma? You know, the equity issues behind that. So I really like this idea of we need to be moving from the system that was created for sorting children into a system of learning.
Right. Yeah. No, it's real because, you know, when you say equity is an issue in everywhere, I agree with that 100%. We could talk about the hood in L.A., right? We talk about the hills of Appalachia. We're talking black, we're talking Latino, we're talking white, we're talking... It hits every kid. Kids who are born in this country, kids who come speaking a different language. It doesn't matter. Depending on where you are, there is someone, or there are many someones, for whom the school system as currently constructed is not meeting needs. And this is an imperative. You know, when you think about the job of school, or the primary function of school historically was sorting, there wasn't necessarily an altruistic sorting. It was like, you know, the kids who need more versus the kids who are doing all right. No, it was the kids who will go on and get a higher education and the kids who will work in factories, right? And then so today when we're like, oh, college for everyone, and, you know, you see, I think it means well, but we see schools with like college or die. They like make it this mantra. It's like college or die. Well, that's a lot of pressure to put on kids when you haven't updated your model to account for all of the new ways that kids come into school, the different readiness levels, the different ability levels, the different levels of preparation. Right, because even here in Providence, I used to work here in Providence. If you know what elementary and middle school a kid comes from, you can probably predict if they're better prepared for high school. And if you know what high school they go to, if it's not classical, you can kind of guess what type of preparation they're getting. It's not fair. It's, you know, and equity, for me, it's not about, just to be clear, it's not every kid getting the same thing. It's every kid getting what they need. And that's not something that you, it's not an algorithm for that. It takes a personal touch.
Right, and that's what we've been hearing a lot about, and we both believe deeply in, is the idea of relationships are the foundation for good learning. And you don't know what a kid needs or what a kid wants unless you build a relationship with them. And if you're thinking about building relationships with kids, you might quickly realize that college is not what this child wants.
Right.
But at the same time, maybe college is something that they could use. And I'm a person who's looking at that saying, how can I work with this child to help them understand a broad approach? Mm-hmm. Or really, this is something that this student has a passion for and a desire to learn, and they won't stop learning about this idea. How can I direct them down a pathway that can make that their career and their future,
right,
rather than focusing them away from it because they care about it, but it's not what we're supposed to do for
right.
kids? And I think that's a major component of it, is building those relationships in what we do.
Right. It's like, I think we got to get... be careful with language, right? When we make it all about college, even though we mean post-secondary options, there's a way that we message to kids that if it's not college, it's not good enough, mm-hmm. right? And so while I agree 100%, just getting through high school is not enough. Like, that is not going to help you. I mean, except for the extreme outliers, you are not going to be making the amount of money you need to take care of your family, to provide for your future children, or to take care of your parents, you know, all the things you want to do, to see the world, to have nice things. You're not going to do that in most cases if you solely have the high school diploma. But what comes next doesn't have to only be college. And it doesn't have to be college first. That's the other thing. We assume that if you don't go right to college, it's a failure. But my father was a high school dropout, joined the military, got his GED, and then earned his bachelor's and master's the military. So his teachers are probably like, oh, this kid's not college material, but look at him now, you know. So we have to be careful with language. Open it up. Post-secondary options, make sure every kid has it. The other part of it is, I think that we want you know, we think it's an equity thing. We want black and brown kids, we want students of color to go to college, we want to equalize things. But the reality is that historically, when those options were limited to people who look like me, the way that folks were pulling themselves out of poverty and into a middle class was through trades, right? If you become a plumber, if you are HVAC certified, or you're an electrician, or you know some of those skill sets, people can't mess with you on your wages. It costs what it costs to install this or to do this. I'm a professional. And that was a way to equalize. It didn't necessarily fully equalize racial inequity, but it certainly started to do some sort of leveling. And so when we start to direct kids away from those programs that are usually free, and they're being paid because they're interning or they're apprenticing, to say every kid has to go to college, but then we're not committed to getting them through college. The only thing we're guaranteeing is that they take on debt. And dropping out of school early with debt and no credential, how have we equalized anything? How is that equitable? As I said in the breakfast panel, all you've done is you've made the opportunity gaps greater.
Absolutely. I am really into this idea of gatekeeping right now. I think that, and something I've learned from Dennis doing the podcast, is we really set up this gatekeeping scenario with conformity. You know, and it's, you put all these great kids in a room that just got out of like elementary school, lots of play, lots of learning. And then, you know, we get into middle school and high school, and it's almost this social experiment of put everybody in the room and see who can conform. Mm-hmm. And those people who can conform over that like 4 to 6 years, those are the ones who get that gatekeeping opportunity to go to college, you know, through all of those different gatekeepers that they, those teachers or educators that they encounter, you know, all the way down into middle school, all the way up to high school. And so let me ask you this. What do you think are some of those traditional gatekeepers in education that we need to, you know, maybe lower those gates, or at least, you know, make it easier to get over that hurdle for those students who, you know, the world is full of people who don't conform, who are successful, mm-hmm. right? Those are the stories we look for. Those are the stories that are in books, movies. And how do we remove, you know, in our everyday education system, those, you know, those gatekeepers? How do we do that?
Well, I think I look at the gatekeepers as being the humans, right? The people. I think when I think about some of the biggest or most well-known outliers, you know, the folks who've been successful in spite of, they, just to be honest, that most of them are white men, right? And why is that? I think it's because we have archetypes of success, and we don't maybe intend for it to be racialized or to be biased, but when most of this teaching staff in schools are white and they see white boys and they maybe act differently, we see, oh, maybe he's gifted or maybe he's this, and we try to, you know, create channels for that energy. And so like a Bill Gates, people say, oh, he dropped out of school. Yeah, but by the time he dropped out of college, how many thousands of hours of exposure had he had to programming at a time when most people didn't have access to a computer, right? So he didn't go to college, but he certainly had an advanced certification, if you will, due time on task. I think the gatekeepers we need to work on are the people who are responsible, who have a sacred, in my opinion, sacred stewardship for our kids' education. Teachers are a gatekeeper. How do you reframe your in-class narrative so that you're not like trying to make sure that every kid, like you say, that we're not sorting them? This is not a social experiment. It is, Dennis, I want to get to know you. I want to know what you're motivated by. And I want to try, if it's humanly possible, to make connections between that and what I think is an amazing future. Not that I'm dictating it, but I'm going to help you imagine one, and then from there give you the opportunity to iterate on that and to customize that. So I think teachers are a big gatekeeper for that. I think guidance counselors are a big gatekeeper for that. When I went, we had a school visit. One of the Ivy Leagues came when I was in high school, and I was blown away, and I was like, I want to go there. Like, look at that library. I was an avid reader, and I was like, they have millions of books. That's where I want to be. And so when all my other friends went to start signing up for SAT2s so that they could apply, my guidance counselor was like, you need to take SATs again. I don't even think she knew what my SAT score was. But I was the only black kid in all of my advanced courses. I was the one directed away. I don't know that that's why, but it's, I have never stopped wondering about, same thing when I was an undergrad in college, right? An academic advisor. Right, these advisory roles, these counseling roles, we give people a title, and that carries weight. And so when I was in college and I said, what did you want to do? And I wanted to go to graduate school, and I told her where I wanted to go. She said, her first thought was, well, you know, not everyone gets in there. Forgetting my resume, forgetting my achievements, forgetting the awards that I had earned in undergrad that she was fully aware of, because I didn't fit an archetype. So for me, it's not even thinking about gatekeepers as in terms of programs or opportunities, as much as those opportunity gaps exist, it's really the people opportunity gap. It's a mindset gap. We often, you know, before opportunity gap, it was achievement gap, and we felt like it put too much blame on kids. I think it's a mindset gap, and it's the adults. We have to take responsibility for that. And this is not a pointing the finger at white teachers. I think it's across the board, educators of all races and ethnicities. None of us are exempt from having to do that important work of self-examination and reflection and say, do I have an archetype for success, right? Am I only directing my boys to these opportunities? What about my girls? Am I making sure that my, you know, am I because my students are learning English, am I assuming that they're weak in other subjects, right? Just because a kid's first language is in English doesn't mean they are not excellent at math. They don't already get scientific concepts, that they're not ready to go into like a STEM lab or a makerspace or whatever. So how are we unintentionally closing doors on kids because we think, oh, I want to get them ready first? Well, let them go for it. Let them try. Give them the space to make mistakes because you are there. Like I said, it's a sacred stewardship. That's your role. Keep them safe and support them when they make mistakes. Don't limit them or close their doors.
I can't agree with you enough on the idea of a sacred stewardship, with that idea of what do I have available to me that I'm supposed to do the most with? What am I supposed to make the most of? And the answer to that is students. But I see teachers who see, what do I have available to me? And their answers are my classroom, my technology, my time, my contract, my. And the wall goes up when they say, my classroom is my sacred space. So if I don't think you belong here, I will get you out. I don't have, there's a phrase, if I ever hear another teacher keep saying, I don't have the clientele for this class. I'm gonna knock them off their chair because,
you're telling me that the kid in front of you right now, they don't have clientele for their education.
We're
the teachers.
We're the ones who got hired. You know, we're the clients. So, like, there's this problem with this idea that, like, I have to make my environment for me, and we don't. And that's a major issue that creates an inequity, and that makes those gatekeepers, who should be the ones who are opening doors, the ones who are on the other sides chaining them shut. Yep. And I believe that what you really said was that viewpoint and that mindset of, as a teacher, you are in my room right now, which means I will do the most for and with you, not the most to get you out of here. And as a guidance counselor, my father was one for 30 years. Like, nobody built relationships like he did, and I learned that from him. It's like, who are you and what do you want? Now let me, someone who knows a little bit about how to get you there, help you get there. Yep. Not, this is what I think you should do, now listen to me and don't do anything else.
Jeffrey Duncan Andrade, I think it was him, he used the metaphor or the image of a garden, right? A classroom is a garden. And he said, there are no weeds here. Every single student here is a native to this garden. This is where they're supposed to grow. That mentality of like getting kids out is this idea that some people belong and some don't. It's a vestige of the sorting. And when you turn that switch on adults' heads, and to be completely fair, most of those ideas originated when they were in school, and right? So it's been handed down. So not bad people, just a bad mindset or unhealthy mindset. But like when you can change that switch and they say, okay, there's no one here by accident, all the kids belong here, they're all indigenous, quote unquote, to my classroom, it starts to change things, right? Because I kicking this kid out is not an option. The only option is to educate that kid, and to do that you have to have a relationship. Like you said, you have to know the kid in order to educate a kid.
We could keep talking about this for a long time. I am excited to follow up with your work. I loved your keynote.
Thank you.
I love this conversation.
Praise the Lord.
Could you let our listeners know how they could follow up if they're interested in some things that they heard today, how they could get a hold of you, how they could read more about you and maybe some of your work?
Sure. So I mean, one of the quick, easy ones is you go to tntp.org. You can jump on the blog. We just did one recently where I talked about how we forget about indigenous youth. Another way is on Twitter. Try to stay active on that. J_Santos Silva. So SANTOSSILVA. And then, I mean, email too. J.Santosilva@gmail.com. Just shoot me an email. I mean, I love jumping on Zoom and getting to know people and see them and talk about these issues. My big bet is that there are a lot more folks who agree with us and the way we were talking than who are against us, but we often feel isolated. That's a part of the school, the egg crate build of a school, is we get in our room and we think that's it. But there are, I want to believe that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of educators who believe the way we do, and so we need to connect. So I'm just reach out.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the Instant Relevance podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Again, if we're here at this, I guess, lunchtime break, busy at the Highlander Institute Blended and Personalized Learning Conference with Matthew Joseph, who is the Director of Digital Learning and Innovation. He's in Milford. And also a Future Times 10 author, who that's the Hacking Series and the Leadership Series. And so welcome. Thank you for being here with us and for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd love to toss our lead question out to you, which is, you know, you're involved in a lot of different places and a lot of different aspects of education. What is exciting you and just creating passion and energy for you in education right now?
So for me, one of the things that is really a hallmark of the work that I'm doing is around active learning in classrooms. Students don't come to school to watch teachers work. And for me, what's really important is to have that opportunity for students to do something that is creating content versus consuming it. So for example, if there's a lesson idea, creating a YouTube channel, creating a presentation, something that is the goal of the lesson is intact, the students have some freedoms to really create content that matches their learning style, that showcases their learning, and that highlights their talents. It could be writing, it could be acting, it could be creating a movie. So for me, what is really front and center right now is creating an active learning environment where students are creating content, not just consuming it by being in the classroom, and they're not doing school. They're participating in the learning.
I think that's great because, writing down some notes here about active learning, creating versus consuming. And the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, that's a shift for teachers, right? So what parts of the teaching practice do you see need to change in order for us to be able to reach students on that level to make an active learning environment? Because, you know, I review curriculum all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm a curriculum coordinator now, and looking at even just math curriculum, it is. I mean, all the new math curriculum that are highly rated are active learning. It's harder to implement. You know, it's definitely harder to implement than just opening up the book and teaching the math problems. So what needs to shift in teaching practice in order for that to happen?
I think a few different things. One, I think taking a step back from instructing, because the ones that are doing the talking are doing the learning. And what that also means is knowing what tools are out there to support learning. I talk a lot about planning. Planning is a critical piece of this shift. And what I mean by that is I talk a lot about driving your instruction. And I use the words GPS. Set your lesson GPS. What are your goals? What is your plan? And then you loop in the solutions. And when the solutions, the digital solutions or different types of solutions, support the learning, it's going to be relevant to students. It's going to give them a choice in how they're presenting the information. And it'll allow teachers to still feel that they have some autonomy over the content, but allowing the students to create the products, almost in a design thinking way.
And I really appreciate the GPS model of it. It's actually kind of funny because one of the last sections of Instant Relevance in the book is recognizing that learning is like Google Maps. You know, I got this Google map. It's like,
yep.
We have a destination and we have a starting spot, but you type it in and it's going to give you three different routes to get there.
Correct.
It's going to give you the most direct or the most scenic or the one that avoids tolls or whatever it is. But behind that is that we have a goal and a plan and those solutions which might have to redirect along the way. Those mm-hmm. ideas of this is how I want this to go, but I can change that if it doesn't go that way. And that's a powerful thing to tell teachers is that this learning is not about, like you mentioned before, which I loved, kids don't come to school to watch teachers work. Like, I don't go to a doctor's office because I like watching a doctor work.
Right.
I go to have him analyze what's up with me and give me a solution to my problem.
Correct.
And I feel like it's important for teachers to recognize that, you are just acting sometimes. And if you're on a video, if you just want kids to watch you work, make a video, put it out there, mm-hmm. let them watch you work because you're not going to interact. But instead, this plan, this GPS version of it really does make it an active environment for you.
Yes.
So as you discuss that with teachers and as you work on implementing that in places, what do you do when you reach some resistance and some pushback against that?
So there's going to be roadblocks, not to continue the metaphor.
Keep it up. That's all good.
But I think because it's rooted in the pedagogy and it's rooted in teachers planning, the first real step in making this shift is building a relationship of trust with teachers. And if you start with the solutions, I'm coming in to say, this is how I can fix it, or this is how I can make it better. But if we start with, what do you want to teach today? Show me what you're going to teach, or probably wouldn't be today, but if we say, what are you going to teach next week? Let's look at what that plan would be. And the teacher's invested in that content. Then when we start to talk about, here's some options to enhance that learning for students, not solutions because you're not doing it correctly or doing it, do it differently because we have Chromebooks now. It's providing solutions to enhance lessons. So it's really building the trust. It's being visible. It's being vulnerable to go in and teach a lesson myself into a classroom that I may not have ever been a teacher of, but to say, I believe in this. And when people see that the leader or the person supporting the initiative believes in it to that capacity, they're going to get that trust and buy-in a lot quicker.
So I really like how you talked about building those relationships with teachers, because I'm a coach now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could step into a classroom and say, you know, I would fix it this way. But the real trick is, you know, getting someone to see that something needs to change for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I know that we spoke last week or about a week and a half ago, and you talked to me a little bit about your role. You really work with a lot of administrators even. I guess my question is, you know, if you're talking to administrators about the need for some of these things, and how do you get that to trickle down to even that teacher who might, you know, be really strongly rooted at the front of that room, who doesn't understand that student voice is as important? How do you kind of reach that last mile teacher to let them know that, like you just said, people doing the talking are doing the learning? You know, how do we reach that kind of last vestige of teacher who needs to make that shift?
I think another piece of this shift, because as educators, we're not wired for change. We're wired for survival, in a sense. And a piece of that is always holding on to something. So to make that shift of the resistant teachers, as you were saying, is really look at their emotional intelligence, meaning they became teachers for a reason. What was that reason, and tap into that? For me, my Aunt Nancy, who worked at Northeastern, talked to me about the importance of education. I want to honor that moving forward. And each teacher got in for a reason. And if we start talking about, why did you get into education? How were you as a learner? And then they feel a little bit more comfortable hearing how students today learn. And when you kind of take that emotional intelligence and say, I want the best for the students that are in front of me, and then present them with, this is how those students learn, it helps make that shift. The second piece of that is to create a psychological safe environment where we can say, take one step. If it's creating a Google Doc with a link to a few of the lessons that you do, just do that. And once it starts to have one success, two successes, start a Twitter account, follow five people. Once you allow teachers to take a small step, they start to become independent and see what's out there and became excited themselves and want to learn more. And then when they come back to you and ask, then you know you're on the right track. If they're not asking over time, find another way to get in.
So that's what's exciting today. We've had a lot of opportunities to interview people from different backgrounds, but we keep hearing the same strand. And a lot of it is about relationship building and moving forward in that. And one person mentioned to us the idea in our own lesson planning of that provocative moment, that hook, creating something that interests kids enough that they start to ask questions about it. Yep. And similarly, what you're saying is recreate that hook for teachers. Why do you care? Why are you here? This is why I'm here. Why isn't it working? All of a sudden they're asking questions about it, and we can provide those released pieces of information that can say, why don't we take a look at it together? Let's do this and grow together. Like I said, in a vulnerable and supportive way that's not, I went to a workshop, I found a bunch of answers, I came back, here are the answers, pick which one works best for
Correct.
You. So it doesn't apply and it doesn't transfer. But when you dig down deep and they realize, I went into this for kids and this is who kids are, then you're right. Even on their own, they'll look and say, well, maybe I should think about who kids are a little bit more right now.
Yeah.
And it creates a powerful moment for them. So
great.
you've given us a lot to think about today.
Well, that's
and
good.
I'm excited for you because you have a session coming up where
I
you get
do.
To share with us as well. So for our listeners, how can they get in touch with you or how are they going to connect with you on social media to make sure
they
could get to you?
They can follow me on Twitter. It's just Matthew X Joseph on Twitter. Or I write a blog with a lot of these, both with leadership and around digital solutions and tools, and that's techinnovation.live, and that's also on the Twitter page as well. And I try to just, if I have a thought, I'll write something about today and all the learning that it took away and different things. This alone is a way of active learning that kids can start to use with their own lessons and their own, create their own podcasts and create ways that works for them to be successful with the content, because at the end of the day, that's why we're all here. The kids that walk through the door are successful in retaining the learning that teachers want them to have.
And you mentioned something, writing for, what, Times 10?
Yep.
Do you have a book coming out?
I do. I have one that's out there right now. It's called The Power of Us, Creating Collaborative Communities. I do a lot of work around creating a community that enhances student learning. So that's out now, Power of Us. You can get it on Amazon. And then the next book coming out is through Times 10 Publishing. Dennis also wrote for them as well. It's about the modern mentor, how mentoring teachers and leaders in education today looks a little bit different, and how to create a mentoring pool and how to create positive mentor relationships to enhance new teachers or new to the field teachers.
I like that as a coach and a teacher mentor. I'm looking forward to picking that up. So
awesome.
Thank you so much for taking the time to stop by, and I really hope that the session goes well. I'm sorry
Great,
I have
so
to
I.
miss it.
No problem. Yeah. No problem. You got your work to do.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt.
All right, thank you.